Hi, my name's Cara. I have 5 children. I attempted to breastfeed 2 of them.
Hi, I'm Cynthia. I'm a first-time mum to Ella, and I breastfed for 12 months.
This is Cara and Cynthia, 2 sisters from Sydney. It's safe to say that their children were not born with silver spoons in their mouths. We'll hear a bit more from the pair later on in the program, but first, how long should women breastfeed for?
When the World Health Organization looked at the evidence around babies' health and well-being, they recommended that babies in all countries should be exclusively breastfed for around 6 months, and then thereafter should continue to have breastfeeding alongside solids and other fluids up to at least age 2.
This is Mary Renfrew, Professor of Mother and Infant Health at the University of Dundee in Scotland. She is also a key technology partner at the University of Technology Sydney. Mary says people have latched on, excuse the pun, to the first half of this statement, the breastfeed exclusively for 6 months part, but ignore the other half.
And that's caused quite a problem because people think they should breastfeed 6 months and then stop. Actually, it's that exclusive breastfeeding, nothing but breast milk up to around 6 months and then ongoing. So quite a lot of people think that they should actually stop at 6 months. It's become almost a new norm.
In Australia, our breastfeeding rates are inadequate. We get off to a great start, but the drop-off rate is high. Susan Day is the Vice President of the Australian Breastfeeding Association and a volunteer breastfeeding counsellor.
In Australia, we have really good initiation rates, with about 96% of women starting to breastfeed. Sadly, the reality is, by 5 months, only about 15% of babies are being exclusively breastfed, and only 60% are receiving any breast milk. What this means is women want to breastfeed, but for various reasons are unable to continue to do so.
So over 90% of women start to breastfeed in hospital, but by the time the 5 to 6 month mark hits, only 15% of babies are exclusively breastfed, in line with the World Health Organization guidelines. And I should mention that those guidelines are strict. As soon as a baby has had one bottle of formula, they are no longer exclusively breastfed. Women generally stop breastfeeding in the first few weeks after leaving hospital. Some reports say over half of that 90% will have stopped breastfeeding 3 to 4 weeks after birth. Which brings us to the crux of this story. Why do women stop breastfeeding? Mary Renfrew again.
It's very influenced by socioeconomic background. There's an inequalities gradient, if you like, that more affluent women are much more likely to start and much more likely to continue to breastfeed. And women from poorer backgrounds are much less likely to start and much less likely to continue, which is, if you like, it's helping to continue the inequalities.
This is true in the United Kingdom, and it's also true in Australia. Breastfeeding rates are pretty consistent state to state, but suburb to suburb, it's a different story.
Yeah, particularly suburb to suburb, there tend to be, women who continue breastfeeding usually are those who have a high intention to breastfeed, and often they have higher education and more capacity to get help with breastfeeding, more capacity to kind of manage their lives so that they can continue to breastfeed. So if they do have to return to work, they can manage that.
This is Lisa Amir, a GP and lactation consultant. She's also an associate professor at La Trobe University in Melbourne.
Whereas women, often in lower income areas, tend to be women who usually have a lower intention to breastfeed. And then it kind of becomes a bit self-fulfilling that they don't see women breastfeeding in their local area. They're more likely to have mothers who didn't breastfeed and, follow what they did and will say, well, you were formula-fed, bottle-fed, you were fine.
And this is, of course, backed up by statistics.
In the highest income group, 22% stopped by 4 months, and in the lowest income group, 40% stopped by 4 months.
A recent Australian study looked at 2,000 Australian women to find out what characteristics could predict that a woman would stop breastfeeding. Professor Julie Quinlifan was the lead author for that study, and she agrees that education, but also smoking levels, play a huge part.
So from the mother's point of view, mothers who smoke before pregnancy and also continue to smoke during pregnancy, and mothers with poorer levels of education, they're much more likely to start but then rapidly discontinue breastfeeding.
It's important to note that across all socioeconomic groups, mothers recognise the importance of breastfeeding.
We know from surveys that women from all socioeconomic groups actually know, they do know, that breastfeeding has a whole lot of health benefits.
The problem lies in the culture. Mary Renfrew again.
It's the cycle of disadvantage, intergenerational disadvantage, but it's very practical in this sense, in that if you're having a baby now and you're living in a community where the rates, breastfeeding rates are very low, you may not know people who've breastfed. Your mother, your grandmother, your aunt, your sister, your neighbour, your friend may well all be formula feeding, have formula fed, and so you won't have anybody knowledgeable around you. And if you start to breastfeed, they might just think you're a bit weird.
The importance of breastfeeding is only just starting to become more prevalent. It's well known that breastfeeding can increase the risk of certain illnesses.
They're more likely to get a number of acute short-term diseases like gastroenteritis, like ear infections, like respiratory infections. And then there's longer-term complications as the child grows and even into adulthood, of diabetes, for example, increased diabetes. There's evidence of increases in some cancers. Onwards and upwards into childhood and adulthood, celiac disease, for example.
Which really becomes a problem when you consider that breast milk is free and hospital care for these complications is not. Susan Day again.
We know that the cost of formula feeding, it's not just in the price the mother pays when she buys the tin of formula, that there's a lot of other, I suppose, hidden costs, financial costs that come with that. We know that not breastfeeding is associated with increased risks of a whole pile of various health incomes, so that there's more likely to be, for formula-fed children, more visits to the doctor, more hospitalisation. So that in itself costs money, with visits to the hospital and then medications. But there's also, you know, if the mother was working, she's losing income because she has to have time off work to look after a sick child. So there's a lot of other hidden costs.
In the UK, Professor Renfrew and her team actually crunched the numbers on how much not breastfeeding was costing the healthcare system.
We looked at all the outcomes and we took the really, really ones we were really confident in, where we could absolutely say with certainty that this would be increased, and it'd be increased by this amount. And we only costed those outcomes. And we looked at breast cancer in the mother, because you'll also get increased breast cancer if you don't breastfeed, as well as the short-term ones. And we've worked out different scenarios. So if you had breastfeeding rates raised to certain amounts, how much money would be saved? And it was many, many, many millions of pounds a year, only for the diseases where we were really, really confident.
You're listening to Think Health on 2SER. We're currently looking at the state of breastfeeding in Australia. So it's pretty obvious that investing in breastfeeding is a good idea. But is it that simple? We introduced Cara and Cynthia earlier on in the program. If you remember correctly, Cara has tried to breastfeed two of her five children, and Cynthia has just finished breastfeeding her first child, who's now 12 months old. There were two reasons that Cara gave up breastfeeding.
The first one was 2 or 3 weeks. The second one was probably a week and a half.
So why did you have difficulties breastfeeding?
The first one, it just didn't seem like I had enough milk for her, and she constantly cried. I tried expressing, nothing was coming out, and so I just swapped to formula. The second time, I had to stop because I got mastitis.
Cara said she knew the benefits and was encouraged to breastfeed, but believed she couldn't do it.
You're very pressured. by the midwives to breastfeed. They'll go on for days about the benefits and why it's better. But I just feel like if you can't do it, you can't do it.
On the other hand, Cynthia always had the intention to breastfeed.
Well, some of my mum friends that I'd made when I was pregnant and childhood friends, they always commented on how lovely it was breastfeeding and they had a really good bond. And I thought I'd give it a go. I did see my mum breastfeeding my younger siblings. So I always thought, you know, if I could do it, why not?
Cynthia said she struggled with breastfeeding in the beginning, but home visits from midwives and child and family health nurses helped.
I thought I'd come this far. If I can make it another few weeks, then be great. And then a few weeks turned into another month and another month. So, but the midwives came to visit. They taught me a lot of tricks and they just encouraged me. And then I read a lot of things online. I know it's not common for a lot of young mums to breastfeed, but I wanted to be a little bit different and keep going.
Cynthia was 21 when she had Ella, who is now 12 months old. Cara was 16 when she had baby number one. Both girls feel that their community encouraged breastfeeding, but it was harder as a young mum. Cynthia in particular has seen both sides of the coin. She has been a part of two mothers' groups. One, a young mum's group, who she said had minimal breastfeeding support, and an older mother's group, who had a lot more support.
I don't think it's so much harder. I think other factors come into it and there are reasons people choose not to breastfeed.
And I think there may be less encouragement. I mean, the young mum's group I'm in, they're a different socioeconomic group to the older mums. I see the older mums and they have a lot more support because they know where to go for help, whereas the young mums, sometimes they don't have that or they just have other people discouraging. Well, then just tell them, they don't really tell them about breastfeeding and things like that. So I'm not too sure. I think breastfeeding's free, so it would be a benefit for the lower income earners and things like that.
Cynthia says that the majority of women breastfeed their babies in her older mother's group, but in the younger mother's group, she was one of two out of six mums that breastfed.
Yeah, so the young mums, only two of us breastfed. One of them's still going, so that's good.
So in your young mums group, do you know why the other women...
I talked to some of the mums and they said that they thought that they didn't have enough milk. They didn't know if their baby was hungry or not, which is a common problem in the first few weeks because you don't know how much baby's getting. You're wondering if they're hungry all the time. But they go through growth spurts where they're hungry all the time and they want to cluster feed. And I had my midwife tell me all of these things, so it encouraged me. Yeah, it encouraged me a lot because I was expecting her to be more hungrier. And so when she was hungrier after she just had a feed 2 hours ago, it wasn't because I didn't have enough milk, it was because she was going through a growth spurt. Whereas I talked to the mum in my mum's group, she's like, oh, I didn't have enough. She was just hungry all the time. And I was like, oh, I wish, you know, somebody was there too, you know. But at the end of the day as well, sometimes it doesn't work for the mums. If they can't feed every 2 hours and if they've got, you know, things to do as well where they can't have the baby attached to them all the time, then that's okay.
You may have just heard Cara say, nobody told me that. And judging from this story, she's not the only one. So what's the solution? Well, Professor Renfrew is trialling a new program in the UK where women in low-income communities are given money for sustaining breastfeeding over the recommended 6-month period.
We're currently doing a really interesting study that's been quite challenging to design, where we're looking at financial incentives for women living in very low-income communities to breastfeed. And we've now completed a 2-year feasibility study where we've worked with women in very low-income communities and practitioners in very low-income communities to see if we could design a scheme of financial incentives that would work, that was feasible, work out how much for example, the value of these would be and how we would give them, if that would be cash or vouchers in some way, and when we would give it. And we've worked out all the kind of practical things. So it's £200 in total over 6 months, all in £40 lots, if you like, across that time. So we're now testing that in a very large randomised controlled trial to see if it works. We don't know if it'll work. We're not pushing this. We're not advocating it. We're not saying this is the answer. We're saying we're now testing it in a trial in very low-income communities.
Closer to home, Lisa Amir is currently trialling a program where new mothers get called by another woman for support.
We're doing one trial at the moment of peer support for breastfeeding. So this is women having their first baby, and if they agree to go in the trial, then they get linked up to another mother who rings them proactively, so it doesn't rely on them contacting someone for support, another mother who's not a breastfeeding counsellor, just a mother who's breastfed herself and has had some short training. She rings them soon after they come home from hospital with the baby, and then every week or two for the first few months, just at that time when women are at risk of giving up, just to give them some extra support. And that has been successful overseas, but hasn't been tried in Australia yet.
Professor Julie Quinlifan believes all maternity hospitals should be baby-friendly, in line with the World Health Organization guidelines.
So the World Health Organization developed a series of steps that hospitals should take to be baby-friendly to promote breastfeeding. And the World Health Organization ran a randomized trial in Europe where hospitals were randomized to become baby-friendly hospitals or not. And those hospitals that were baby-friendly had significantly better breastfeeding rates, longer rates of breastfeeding. And when those children were assessed intellectually at age of 5 years, those children were brighter.
This involves measures such as training staff and encouraging babies to sleep in the same room as their mother. Cara and Cynthia agree that more needs to be done, especially in the community.
They're all for encouraging you to do it, but when it comes to needing help while you're doing it, it's not there.
So that's when you've left the hospital?
Yeah.
Yeah. Even in the hospital, like, the help they give you isn't really the best. And I think they don't tell you all the information. Like, they tell you there's one way to breastfeed and that's the only way, and if you don't do it that way, then you're not doing it correctly. And in the end, I think partly giving up breastfeeding, I was glad to be giving away the, you know, I'm probably not doing it right anyway, so why bother?
Yes. I mean, today when I was at uni, I was talking with my friend and somebody walked past and she was wearing her baby, like, in a baby carrier, and she was breastfeeding at the same time. And then my friend had a comment, oh, I think she should be covering up. And I said, well, actually, good on her. Like, I wish I could walk around and hold my baby and feed her at the same time. I couldn't do that. I'm not that talented. But if your baby's hungry, you should be able to feed them wherever.